This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Told often enough, any story can get simplified. Narratives surrounding the Civil War are no different. We often think of that conflict as the blue and the gray, but the truth of how the Civil War played out in mountain towns of North Carolina revealed something larger, that the true story is complicated and sometimes even more violent than we like to remember. A new exhibit at the Rural Heritage Museum at Mars Hill University reflects some of these complexities in western North Carolina. It'll be open to the public from August 19th through March 4th. Les Raker is director of that museum. Welcome, Les.
Thank you. Well, and glad to be here.
And good to have you here. And also joining us is David Forbes. David is a journalist and the editor of the Asheville Blade. Their recent piece in Scalawag magazine is an in-depth look at the Shelton Laurel Massacre carried out by Confederate soldiers in Madison County. Welcome to you, David.
Thank you.
Les, let me start with you. Let's talk about Western North Carolina. Is it fair to say that at this point most people or a fair number of people do understand that in Western North Carolina there was not enthusiastic support for the Confederacy?
No, there was not. It was some enthusiasm in the towns, but the rural people were not about it at all. I mean, it was a war by individuals with changing loyalties, really looking only to survive. And the consequences were very brutal for the women, children, former slaves left at home to tend the land. It was something that people, we talk about this idea of brother against brother. We have examples of it we mentioned in our exhibition of people, then people switching sides. They would, one story we have is that the Confederates maybe paid a soldier $11 a month. But if a Union recruiter came up and said, "I'll give you $50 to join up with the this side," they would do it because they needed the money. They needed to get through the winter because people were starving.
And this complexity or this story about how hard it was to make a living in the mountains of Western North Carolina, Western Virginia, for that matter, which became West Virginia, is an important part in understanding the western part of the state's role in this. Because, as you say, it's hard to make a living and again, slavery was not an important. There were not as many slaveholders in Western North Carolina as well.
In 1860, there were only about 300 and some odd slaves in Madison County. There were over 1,200 in Buncombe County, and that kind of depended on the size of the county and how many slaves there were. But from what we've determined, that the local people who lived there who were white people were kind of jealous of the slaves because they would compete with them for jobs. They would be working for nothing, and then they couldn't get jobs themselves. But it was a struggle. There was very little commerce out of the mountains during this period of time. They didn't have much to sell other people. And so when they were put upon, they would end up being really struggling because there wasn't imports and exports going on.
Well, David Forbes, let's talk about this this massacre, the Laurel Shelton Massacre. What drew you to that story in particular?
What drew me to it in part was that I was born and grew up in Northeast North Carolina, which was another region where there was a lot of opposition to the Confederacy. And then I've lived in Asheville, and I heard some similar stories, but also a lot of different stories in each growing up. But one kind of common thing was the level of bloodshed, especially in the mountains, and the level of oppression that was brought to bear. And so I started to, as a journalist, I've always believed that history should be, you know, as major a beat as government. While journalists deal with the here and now, the past shapes all of that, as we've seen tragically in a lot of ways this week. And so the Shelton Laurel Massacre in particular cuts against the distortions, and the American Civil War is one of the most distorted events in our history. As far as the tactics that were carried out, the unit that carried out would be called a death squad. If this were going on today, if this was going on in the 1920s, it would be dubbed that very clearly.
We'll set the scene for us. Tell us. This was January of 1863, Madison County.
Yes.
Tell us about it.
Certainly. So already the divisions in the area are very apparent. You have these Confederate regiments that have the core that is kind of loyal to this regime that's sprung up are, you know, often led by slave owners. There aren't many slave owners in the area, but they overwhelmingly populate the area's elite and the people who hold power. And the people that are tied to and loyal to them. And then the surrounding area have a lot of people who were dealt out of kind of this system, which even when Arizona didn't have a lot of slavery, was very definitely based on that kind of as a power base. And so there's already resentments. And then the war happens, and those resentments kind of split even further. There's violence even before the vote on secession takes place in the middle of Madison. And so in feeling themselves outnumbered, which Confederate commanders repeatedly wrote they felt outnumbered in the mountains, in the winter they haul in all the salt to Marshall in the middle of Madison County. And in this era, if you didn't have salt, you would not survive the winter. And this is a very old tactic, which is if you can't, you know, if you're worried about the local population not liking you, you control the food supply. And so in retaliation, Unionists, and to keep themselves alive and their families alive, Unionists raid Marshall. They shoot the captain guarding the salt supply. They, you know, they sack the town basically as much as they can. They particularly target the homes of the commanders of the 64th North Carolina, which is the later carry out the massacre. And they go back kind of where they came from. And this is interesting because it illustrates that this was a large group of people capable of pulling off a military raid. And then retaliation, the 64th, which is at that point in eastern Tennessee, gets permission, receives sanction from, as far as we can tell, the highest levels of the kind of Confederate command structure, and goes back and to Shelton Laurel itself, which is a region known for being very pro-Union and very opposed to the Confederacy. They seize a bunch of livestock. They have some skirmishes. They torture many of the women that are there and try to get them to tell them where these raiders, Tories, as they often called them, are. And then they end up rounding up a number of people, and one of the unit takes them to an area that everyone around, many of the mountaineers around, can see, and shoots and kills 13 of them in incredibly brutal fashion. This is a very important story, and it cuts very much against kind of the oil painting version of the Civil War that we often get fed.
Yeah, Les Raker, let's talk about this, because this is a story that is not unknown. In fact, the Attorney General of North Carolina was outraged at this and recommended that there be legal action taken against those who were responsible for it. Right?
It's quite complicated, the history that comes down from that, and the facts of the story were pretty much settled that there were 13 men and boys as young as 13, as old as 60. Who were summarily executed that day and built and buried in a shallow grave. Subsequent to that, we have a gentleman who we have even a street named after here, Augustus Merriman, who reported to Zebulon Vance about this and talked about it. And Vance said, well, we have to, you know, punish these people. But there was some past history between Merriman and one of the colonels who was blamed for this, Colonel Keith, in terms of legal battles between them. Now, we don't know this for a fact, but we have letters from Keith indicating that he was fighting this war right to the very end, till 1866, commanding out of Mars Hill, and that he really blamed another gentleman, Colonel Allen, for giving the order to do that. And so there is dispute about that. Well, maybe never know, but we do have letters and also field notes between them that we've recently uncovered. And there are people who live in Shelton Laurel today who have multiple points of view. You ask one person, they'll say this, another person to say that. And you even, if you go to that valley, you ask, well, where was the massacre? And one person will say it was on that ridge, and another person will say it was on that ridge. So there is that. And one of the things we're fighting with this is the kind of oral history, family remembrances of things, which don't really follow the facts. And we may never know the story here. Okay,
We do know that a Confederate unit was responsible for the murders of 13 people. That's clear. Who gave the final order? Those things are particularly because of the personal relationships. And it's complex and actually in some ways interesting, but we shouldn't be confused about the actual event itself. And it happened.
The actual event itself was very brutal and horrific, but one of the things we've discovered, and David can refer to this as well, is that this was not isolated in the Civil War. This happened quite a bit on both sides, but massacres such as this.
David Forbes, talk a little bit more about that, the sense that this might have been a one-off, but in fact this was part of the war effort and the strategy.
As a matter of fact, I think that's one reason the story is so important. this is – and it was a brutal war. Unionist guerrillas regularly resort to assassination, sabotage, you know, burning down homes and bridges and supplies. However, within the South, it was overwhelmingly the Confederacy that resorted to this kind of massacre. And to some degree, that makes total sense. The area – the South was divided from day one. And one of the things left out in the popular narrative was that hundreds of thousands of Southerners fought against the Confederacy in one form or another. Some in official Union regiments, both black and white, some as these bands of, you know, what we call renegades or Tories. But that a lot of the Confederacy, rather than this, you know, one block of states, were these regions of, you know, firm support for this new regime versus places that really, really despised it and fought back. And so the Confederacy had units, many of which only rarely, maybe the last days of the war, if at all, saw combat against the formal Union army that would carry out these massacres. They happened in Texas, they happened in Mississippi, they happened on the North Carolina coast. And so this was part of a larger method of kind of keeping down, to use what one commander of one of these units called restive citizens.
Let's talk about some of the effects of this on Western North Carolina, particularly in the aftermath. You talked about the variety of stories, the ways in which people remember. In the immediate aftermath, what's the impact on people who are trying to put things back together and have these stories that they either don't want to tell or they don't fully understand or they don't want to tell fully accurately? Well, I mean, what's the impact of people trying to put themselves together?
Well, you're exactly right. Everything you just said, people don't want to tell, they don't like to talk about it, or they do like to talk about it. And people, different people remember it in different ways. But even just shortly thereafter, as you know, in this state, both governor, later the senator Vance, and also Merriman fought strenuously against the rights of African Americans and having them become citizens and having them getting the vote. So there was that played out. In our area, there weren't that many African Americans, but there were. And there were also people who – there was, for instance, one man who fought and his wife – joined the battle to get away from his wife. We have that written down. He wrote, "That's why I joined." And then when he came back, he married somebody else who was from the other side, and he was a Unionist, and he settled in Confederate territory, and he seemed to have been left alone for the rest of his life. There are all kinds of – we also have a story of a woman named Sarah Pritchard who joined the war with her husband, pretended to be his brother, and they fought for most of the war. They were from Watauga County, and then near the end, they decided to switch sides, join the Confederate Army the Union, and became a band of guerrilla Union raiders at the end. And she's the only woman we know of that actually took up arms as a soldier.
As you say, you've said this too, that Les, that we, in our sort of blunderbuss understanding of the Civil War as the North and the South, the pro and anti-slavery, freedom versus slavery, that we lose some of these personal stories, some of these narratives that are really reflect some of the complexity, the social complexity of the time.
That's right. I came into this as a person who learned about the Civil War in school. And in Madison County, we had I had five individuals who were very close to this in many ways, who did research as well, and a couple of historians brought all these things to light for me, and I'm hoping that my perspective as kind of an outsider, sharing that with people will be the thing that people take away, maybe can take away, that these are things I never even heard of. I mean, there are many lessons to be learned of survival, of hope, of desperation, the best and worst behavior that mankind is capable of, but those lessons really don't pick any side, and they are as silent as the mountains, as we say, going forward.
David, as you said, Unionists in that area were responsible for atrocities as well. Of course, there would not be any Unionist or atrocities on their side had the Confederacy not declared war against the United States of America. So it sort of begins with the declaration of war against America. And then, of course, opposition, and there are atrocities on both sides. Talk about the aftermath and the impact of massacres like this on the people, again, who are trying to put their lives and their societies back together, and now having these brutal histories to cope with.
So I think a lot of what emerged – I mean, to some degree, partly the war didn't entirely stop. It changed form. There was a lot of repression of Unionist – you know, Vance and Merriman were just mentioned. They did not, whatever their concerns about Shelton Laurel, they did not stint from civilian bloodshed in basically starting to lay the groundwork for Jim Crow. And while I do worry sometimes that when we talk about the Civil War, we can kind of get into both sides-ism. And while certainly Eunice Griddles were plenty brutal, when it came to military units going around, and the 64th is a great example, and this the article I wrote follows its history after the massacre, which is very important in some ways too. You know, the Eunice would, okay, well, they assassinate an officer when he's on leave. You know, they raid a town. At the same time, they don't generally drag out an entire community and kill them. That was more from the Confederacy. And I think that that is essential to note because I think there is a tendency – and this was part of after the war. There was as almost as much a war waged on the past and the way the past is thought about and who was a hero and who wasn't and what history, especially the history of the resistance to the Confederacy, that was covered up and what was remembered. And I think we're still seeing the price of that today. There's a point in 1901 when the captain of the 64th is writing up the history of the regiment, and he brags that afterwards no one, not a single person, and this is after pages of describing, you know, raiding homes and shooting people they thought were Unionists, none of them took the oath to the United States. So they were defiant of Reconstruction. And he's saying this a few years after the Wilmington coup d'etat and massacre, where kind of you've seen the last vestiges of this push for civil rights and the fusionist movement kind of really stamped down. And the South is still paying the price for this. So I think it's important to look at these nuances in history. Also, I think as a journalist and as active citizens today, I think people really need to remember that it is way overdue to have a reckoning with the legacy of this that is still around because there was a very dedicated attempt afterwards to shape how these events were thought about if they were forgotten. You know, Keith got off on a technicality who was – you know, despite all the animus, even if some very local, powerful
this is
people
the,
against
this is,
him.
Forgive me. This is the colonel yes. who was accused of the giving the order. Accused,
yeah. This is the colonel who most accounts placed directly at the center of the massacre. Heath, who was a general who, according to some accounts, said, I don't want to be troubled with any prisoners, and the last one of them should be killed. He ends up escaping anything. Allen gets the other colonel in the 64th gets docked 6 months' pay, but he's raking in so many bribes from his various draft dodging schemes that or letting people dodge the draft that it doesn't really matter to him. So there is a tragedy here that the reality of a lot of what happened, Shelton Laurel was forgotten. The survivors were never compensated. Who knows? You know how many people suffered afterwards? There's letters in the spring afterwards saying what great suffering this inflicted in the area, that even the people who weren't directly hit by bullets, you know, faced possible starvation, faced food being lost. But a lot of the people who are at the center of this basically escape a lot of the justice that was coming to them. And many of them go on to, you know, go into old age extolling their stories, getting to put this gloss. And it still endures to this day. I still think there hasn't been a real reckoning with it.
Les Raker, tell us what folks will see at the exhibit at Mars Hill University.
Well, when you come into the exhibition, we have a film that we put together that's got some live action, it's got some photographs, it's got some narration and narrating letters from women to their husbands and from husbands to their families back home that are really heartrending stories. And we tell the story of the St. Laurel Massacre, but also the aftermath and the legacy of that. We have 18 huge panels that we've have the story told in words and pictures and documents, and they've all been scanned there, so you can just go up and read them. And then we have artifacts that we've borrowed from a number of museums in the area of artifacts from the 1860s during the war. Some, and we have an applique quilt, we have a coverlet that show kind of things, life went on, and people still made great crafts here in Western North Carolina. But we also have a lot of some Confederate ephemera, and some, again, letters and other things made by slaves at the time, some of the principals in this battle. There was one individual quickly who had we have his saddle and stirrups and other things that he had. He was a gentleman who lived in the mountains, walked all the way to Knoxville during the night. And then join the Union Army. That's what I wanted to say.
It sounds great, and we're going to leave the rest to the exhibit itself. Les Raker, director of the Rural Heritage Museum at Mars Hill University. David Forbes, journalist and author of The Massacre Men in Scalawag Magazine. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, a photographer in Durham captures and creates pop-up studios. Hear more on The State of Things. Stay tuned.